The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Last year, there have been some changes, and not the least of those changes is our name. That is the name of the entity which is the sponsor of this annual IP Gender Symposium or workshop. We used to be, I won't even say what we used to be. We are now the Program on Information Justice. What's your problem? It was a problem. What can I tell you? The information justice part was easy. We just stole that from Peter Dropless, and so far we haven't had any objections. The intellectual property part was more difficult. We wanted to lose it all together, but the front office was having none of it, and probably correctly so. 40-odd years ago, when I was a child in the Washington, area, one of the momentous events of the era was being the purchase by the Washington Post of the other then sort of struggling morning daily paper, the Times Herald. And we all, I sort of remember vividly getting up in the morning to see what the front page of the newspaper was going to look like on the first day of joint publication. It said, Washington Post and Times Herald, in their both in Gothic script, nearly equal in size. And then day after day thereafter, the Times Herald part just sort of shrank. And eventually, it took a few years, it disappeared. So we have similar aspirations. The withering away of intellectual property is something we look forward to both in our institutional self-presentation and perhaps in a larger sense as well. Anyway, with the new name, there are wonderful new personnel. Sean Flynn, the Pitchin Associate Director, many of you have met and others will, I hope, before the day is out. Associate Director means that he does most of the work. Mike Palmetto, Pitchin Research Associate. But Sean and Mike have done a lot of the work assembling the materials that you have today, including the wonderful version, what would you say, 235 bibliography that currently updated, and we hope incidentally that if you have suggestions for the bibliography, let us know so that we can include them. So, new personnel, we're delighted. Old personnel, as well, without Putin, et cetera, the irreplaceable Mickey Phillips. Without whom, literally, Steve Roberts, the man who makes the back room, and my other wonderful colleagues, Christine Farley, now I should say, Associate Dean Farley, who has many, many distinctions, of which, from my standpoint, among the most notable is the fact that she designed the wonderful new Pitchin logo, which you now see in the hall. Josh Sarnoff, and Ann Shalek, who was the first of us to step over the boundary between gender studies and intellectual property, inspiring all the rest of us here at WCL to begin crossing over in the other direction. The editors of the IP Gender Journal made a tremendous contribution by publishing the papers that come out of our annual symposium. The school itself, of course, which has been generous in profitably in support of this venture over the years. And this is sort of bittersweet, since the last time I will have to say it, the Markle Foundation, whose money we finally managed to spend this year. It took us a while, but we did it. And unfortunately, there isn't going to be any more because their funding priorities have changed completely in the years since they first made this grant. So, hail and farewell, Markle Foundation. Now, this is just a favorite event of mine. I look forward to it every year, both the rich intellectual stimulation that it offers, and also, frankly, for the mix of friends that this symposium has come to represent. Some old friends who have been with us really from the beginning, taking part in every, or practically every one of these activities, Dan Burke and Marco, among others, and new friends, many wonderful new friends who have been with us for a year or two, or this is even their first year, including new friends who are joining us from halfway across the world, from India, and whose papers you will be hearing in the course of the day. That's an extremely exciting and important development. We look forward not only to their becoming part of the IP Gender Symposium family, but also to taking this precedent further and actually working even harder in the future on internationalizing this discussion. So, my friends. And therefore, I think I can make a confession. A confession is actually very difficult for a confirmed, sort of dyed-wool, highly skeptic, low-protectionist like me to articulate. Because it's rather shameful. But I'll keep it real. When I found out late last year that another law school at the Chelsea Schools was organizing its own day-long IP Gender Symposium for spring 2007, I felt, how can I put it, a pang for my curiosity. You know, no matter how strongly one is committed to the ethic of sharing, giving up exclusivity can hurt its success. It's like letting go of a child who's ready to live on his or her own. A source of joy can also be a source of pain. So for one unworthy moment, I wished intensely that there was some way to keep this to ourselves. Not to WCL as such, but to this evolving community that is represented here in the room. But I got over it, because I think I got over it. And I'm choosing now to interpret this development really is a tribute to what we've done together. That is, in effect, to imagine and then to begin to inhabit a new field of intersectional scholarship, one which some initial skeptics were convinced would turn out to be a null set. They laughed when we sat down at the piano, but let there be no doubt, this is something real and something important. In other ways, too, I think this year's symposium is a time of transition, even a moment of maturity for this IP Gender project. Today, we can look forward to the most diverse range of outstanding papers in the event's history. And we're also pleased and very honored to be able to offer another new feature, and that is opening remarks to frame our day's discussions by a distinguished Egyptian scholar whose foundational writings have been a source of inspiration and intellectual guidance to us all. Professor Margaret Braden Scott, Professor of Law Emerita at Stanford, currently the first Microsoft Law and Public Affairs Fellow at Princeton, and soon joined the law faculty in Ann Arbor, has, over her distinguished career, taught us all about the importance of crossing boundaries. Her work is bridging law and philosophy, ultimately bringing her important insights into property theory to bear on IP. And her current scholarship explores another formidable divide, the line between the physical and the virtual. In these writings, she's helping us to understand, among other things, how metaphors that are rooted in the tangible world operate or fail to operate under the conditions of cyberspace. This work is all of her scholarship does, displays a subtle understanding of the way in which gender enters into how we think and talk about ownership in general and the ownership of intangible goods in particular. So it's truly, truly a delight to have her with us today, Professor Craig.
Thank you for the eloquent introduction. Sometimes when I hear the introduction, I say, is that really me? Thank you very much. It's a delight to be here. Hello. In the past, I'm in my 31st year of teaching. So in the past, which I inhabited, gender awareness entered the legal academy with the addition of a single course called Women and the Law. Of course, those classes were mostly populated by people who were already clued in, like the women. And the mainstream, the required real law courses, never had to confront gender issues. They were eschewed. Some of you will remember, I think, that we had big fights over whether it was necessary even to mention rape in the criminal law classes, for example. No doubt to the discomfort of some of my wonderful colleagues who pioneered those courses called Women of the Law, no doubt they were uncomfortable because I thought of those courses as a kind of ghettoization. However, well-intended, and perhaps they were a necessary first step, I don't deny that, but I thought that the gender issues needed to be mainstream and make it into the required courses rather than being shunted to one survey course. So I thought there should be gender and procedure, gender and contract, gender and property, gender and commercial law, gender and corporate law, and so forth. And indeed, over time, we've seen a flowering of scholarship in these fields, and I don't need to mention all the wonderful people who did, but, Judith Bresnik, gender and procedure, and Leslie Bender, gender and importance, so on. Wonderful, wonderful scholarship in these fields. However, I don't think we've yet seen the curricular integration I hope for. So IP and gender is just as important a topic as these other fill-in-the-blank and gender topics that I just listed. So I'm really delighted to see this initiative in gender and IP, the unmapped connection. It may be a little bit more mapped than it was when you first named it. It's a wonderful development. So I do want to give congratulations to American University's Washington College of Law and all the faculty who spearheaded this. And special extra congratulations for including international perspectives. That's very fine. Special welcome to the guests from India who are thinking about my favorite topic, curricular integration, among other things. Now, I was musing over the outstanding collection of papers we're going to hear today. Musing, I guess I should say, and I thought of five kinds of connection. Maybe five countries on the unmapped map. And so here's how the topics for today teased my particular brain. And after I tell you how I was teased, I'll get out of the way and we can turn the papers. I have five. The first country is intellectual property and the feminist approach to law teaching, as I said. A favorite topic of mine, and the topic of gender in the curriculum, or how to get beyond ghettoization of lip service, is important. And here we have Amita Danda from Hyderabad in India talking about gendering the IP teaching program, and I'm looking forward to hearing that. The second country that teased my brain was intellectual property and feminist analysis of just what I want to call cultural iconography. Now, in particular, I'm thinking about the cultural reification of femininity, by which I mean the propertization and hence the flexing of the cultural iconography that undergirds the gender hierarchy. And so the more we propertize it and reify it and make it protected, the more we can instantiate the gender hierarchy. And trademark is particularly on point when it comes to cultural iconography. That may be the field of IP. It's not the only one to think about, but it's one of the ones. And I do know that a big contribution to feminist theory and feminist activism has been made by the Mattel Corporation. Perhaps unwitting. All right. So we do have some fascinating discussions of branding. Ann Bartow has a rhapsody on the meaning of the branding of the color pink. So just think about that and wait for it. That's great. And Christine Farley has a wonderful, ironic contribution, too, about tarnishment, about women's reputation and tarnishment and dilution. Wonderful. So wait for that, too. All right. Now, area number three that we can think about is, I'm so glad for the inclusion of this, the thinking about intellectual property as it affects women in traditional societies and developing countries. Because of pre-existing positions of women in these societies, as in our own too, but especially in traditional and indigenous societies, intellectual property might have a potential for disempowerment as well as empowerment of women in these societies. So it could be a two-edged sword. So Ruchira Goswami from West Bengal has a wonderful way to lay out the pros and cons of corporatization of these traditional cultural expressions, and especially their relationship to the role of women in these societies, and also modes of women's creativity. So many modes of women's creativity don't lend themselves to the individualistic identification of sole authors and so forth. And I'll let her tell you about it, but it's a good thing. It's an important thing to think about. And then I think it's wonderful to have Helen Long, who's the director of the Food World Intellectual Property Awards of Gender Issues. And it's wonderful to have WIPO thinking about gender issues and how to make intellectual property empowering instead of disempowering for women around the world. And these efforts by World Intellectual Property Organization to implement human rights commitments and make them real on the ground. The gender equality, and so I'm looking forward to her report on developing awareness and the capabilities for women inventors and entrepreneurs. All right, so I'm looking forward to that. And now I'm on topic four, I think. Now, there's also an unmapped field here about and much more to be said here. Number four, intellectual property of women's modes of perception. So, do women actually have different modes of thought and different methods of creativity? And if we do, is this cultural? Is it hardwired? Is it neurophysiological? Should we care? So there's a big field there. I think Ruchira Goswami, as I said, is going to tell us about women's creation in communities and maybe anonymously. So that's a way of creation that isn't eligible for intellectual property in its current forms, and that's an important thing to take note of. And also Elizabeth Judge has a very interesting talk about gender and the visualization modes of intellectual property, because there could be a connection between male dominance and intellectual property through the emphasis on the visual and the de-emphasis of other senses, if in fact that's connected in a gender sort of way. And I'm really looking forward to hearing about that. Now, I guess that was four, so here's five. The fifth part of the map, and one that I've written a lot about myself and I'm still trying to write about, as Peter so kindly noted, is intellectual property and feminist philosophical methodology. This is that whole list of supposed dichotomies. Whenever I put verses on the blackboard in one of my classes, I always put verses in quotes because I always blur the line. So I always put, you know, real versus virtual, et cetera. I blur the line. So whenever I say verses, would you please think of the quote? Okay, but we all know this list. It's individualistic versus relational, abstract versus situated, transcendent versus imminent, fixed versus evolutionary, logic versus narrative, and so forth. All right. Now, know that I wrote a piece called The Feminist Attractiveness in the late 80s, and I actually believe that the philosophical methodology developed by feminists has a lot in common with American philosophical pragmatism, especially John Dewey, but William James to some extent. I don't think they talk about specifically feminist procedures like consciousness raising, so we've added something, but I think they talk a lot about relational, situated, eminent, evolutionary narrative. So that's my perspective. Now, if we were talking about intellectual property and this philosophical methodology, there's a rich field here. Number one, the author or the inventor versus emergent collaborative patient, right? And Jessica Sibley has some wonderful stuff to say about origin myths and intellectual property, which will approach that. And then Dan Burke, talking about do patents have gender, teasing title, talks about the objective mythical single individual person having ordinary skill in the art and whether he or she and versus situated knowledge versus the way innovation really happens in situations of ongoing cooperative situated knowledge. So I am also, I'm looking forward to that, especially because I'm trying to write about this myself, further topics that we could consider and may come up in these papers. The invention, the thing is the light bulb in your head, versus evolving emergent redescription. And the process of drafting claims and prosecutioning them, and they evolve the process, and they're cooperative when they evolve. The process of interpretation is cooperative. The process of use and improvement of innovations in the world is cooperative, and nothing stays still. So I think that's important to think about when we think about the propertization of this thing called the invention, and also the linguistic debate that's now going on the Federal Circuit. Josh talks a lot about this. There is, and all of you who majored in English know this, I think, there's a big fissure in our culture between people who believe in plain meaning, objectively, the texts speak to us of themselves, and also the opposite, versus the holistic, practice-based linguistic interpretation in a situated understanding. There are two holistic diehards on the Federal Circuit, and everybody else thinks texts speak to us of themselves. And they are fighting, essentially in a teapot, about whether they speak to us of themselves this way or that way. And there's a lot of wonderful scholarship coming out on that, some by Josh, and I'm writing about this myself, but I think that the gender connection can well be brought to bear on this, as well as some others. So those are my five, and I think we can get started. I just want to say one more thing, and that is, I guess this is number six, and that is everybody, throughout all of these papers, we see feminist varieties of political and social activism, and that is consciousness raising and community building and patience and persistence. We've all done that. And inclusion, not exclusion, which is a wonderful thing to see. So I appreciate everybody here, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. And I will now sit down and thank you.